because I don't want to go backwards. I want to keep going forward together. That's exactly where we're going to go.
This is Rewind. I'm Sean Johnson in for Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
I think Steve's going to have quite a bit to review from this past week, one of those busy weeks in the legislature.
Picked a good week to be off.
Yeah,
much.
Right. So they're getting all geared up for this upcoming floor period, yep. Especially the Assembly. You had a couple big bills that they've been talking about for a while. Finally got a hearing. Let's talk about the Government Accountability Board bill first. So this is going to, I think it's safe to say that the Government Accountability Board, as we know it now,
yes.
That's going to be gone.
That was probably the best show in town this week. If you're a political junkie, I was watching Kevin Kennedy get grilled for 2 hours by members of the Assembly and Senate campaign committees. I mean, you could really see a divide in the parties of how they view Kennedy and the GAB, right? For Republicans, this guy is an arrogant bureaucrat who's lost touch with reality, saying that they do a damn good job, to quote Kennedy, in overseeing elections. To Democrats, you guys, like, look, this guy is being persecuted by a partisan witch hunt. Go down swinging, you know. Stick it to him, Kevin, kind of thing. So, but that was kind of the show, if you will. But the nitty-gritty is we're going to vote in the Assembly next week on the overhaul of the GAB bill. They've had to massage it several times to get back the intent of what the authors intended. That includes things like it will be a six-member commission. At one time, they'd written a way that the Democratic and Republican parties both got to pick as well to make it an eight-member commission, maybe nine if a third party got 10% in a gubernatorial election. Now it's back to six. They've made sure the picks are going to be balanced. And for backers, they're saying, look, we've tried the quote-unquote nonpartisan approach, but these Dems keep talking about the partisan background, the appointees of the GAB right now, who are all happy Republicans. It's not a true nonpartisan board. Let's not kid ourselves. Let's try and go for the FEC model and be three and three. That requires consensus for any decision going forward and do it that way. And it's clear they've got the votes. The Republicans, if you look at a lot of these things too, the campaign finance rewrite, the John Doe changes, the GAB, they all reflect conservative frustrations with the John Doe investigations of Governor Walker and his aides, their frustration with the GAB over the recall process, their frustration with the recall process where if you donated to a Republican, you know, they looked at what business you belong to and they would boycott those businesses if you're an opponent of, you know, candidate X. It's all reflections of this frustration building for 4 years of they feel like they've been wronged. And it's been a bias system against them.
So before we move on, we got to talk about that exchange between Kevin yeah. Kennedy and Senator Chris Kapinger there. You've covered Kevin Kennedy quite a number of years. Do you ever remember him?
No.
So just to backtrack, Chris Kapinger was asking about Lois Lerner.
Yes.
So this is the IRS official, controversial IRS official in charge of auditing many of these conservative, mm-hmm. tax-exempt conservative groups. Conservatives don't like her. Emails come out in the Wall Street Journal editorial
yes.
page showing that she's friends with Kevin Kennedy. Chris Kapinger asks about that, and Kevin Kennedy says, seriously, have you no decency? Yeah. Calls it McCarthy-esque.
Yeah.
He eventually did answer the question, though. It was a pretty awkward moment in the hearing.
Well, for Kevin, from his perspective, he's answered this question before. If you go back to late news coverage, I mean, we've all written stories about these emails came out, the Wall Street Journal editorial page, and by the way, through the editorial page, not through the front page of the paper, mm-hmm. which would be kind of interesting to watch. But they came out, and Kevin said, it's a professional relationship. I've known this person for 25 years or something like that. We've developed a personal friendship outside of the professional relationship, but there's nothing more than that. Conservatives, though, see like the conspiracy of, okay, there's something going on here where these groups, these government agencies are out to kind of investigate us, to kind of cause us grief. There's something going on. I get the impression that Kevin was kind of tired, if you will, of the line of questioning, the questioning of his credibility or his ethics. I feel like that was one line too far. Now, you know, that line may have been rehearsed or prepared in his back pocket of, okay, if they go after me, I've got this to bring up. But clearly a moment of frustration for him of, look, you know, this is enough. You know, enough of questioning he's been there for 30-some years overseeing election law, enough of questioning my credibility as a person.
So one more big substantive change in these bills, aside from the boards and the makeup, is this idea we're not going to have some sufficient funding for investigations anymore. And, you know, maybe people nod off when they hear the term some sufficient, but that's a pretty big deal. I remember when they formed the Government Accountability Board, it was important that that was going to be in there, that this board would have the money to go where the investigation took them.
Yeah.
Why is this not in the new Ethics and Elections Commission?
The John Doe investigations. I mean, that's the bottom line, really, is that They saw it, an investigation began. Remember, this whole thing began back in 2010, I think it was, because then County Executive Scott Walker's office notified the DA in Milwaukee County that there's some money missing from this kind of veterans program. That turned from that to there's something else going on to something else going on, and it kept expanding and expanding and expanding. Then, when John Doe 1 ended, there were some loose strings, became John Doe 2. For Republicans, it's been a never-ending investigation with no check and balance, if you will. So for Democrats this week, it's like, look, you guys are trying to take the teeth out of the agency by essentially giving the Joint Finance Committee oversight of investigations. If for example, you have a committee that's controlled by one party, like right now you have 12 Republicans and 4 Democrats, if they have an inkling that that investigation is about a Republican, would they shut it down? Now that's a hypothetical we may not ever have to deal with, if you will. But they're saying, look, you're trying to give lawmakers, the people being overseen by the overseer, you're giving them oversight of the overseers, if you will. That's kind of a little bit odd situation. Republicans say, look, no, they just have to come back and prove they need the money. You know, the blank check is over. Let's kind of get some rein in, some sanity, if you will, what's happening with this process.
Okay, so about 7 hours into that hearing on the GAB, they got to this major rewrite of Wisconsin's campaign finance laws, the likes of which we haven't seen in decades. Huge changes there. Run through a few of them.
Well, the bottom line is they're taking a lot of the court decisions from the last 4, 5, 6 years that have gutted Wisconsin's campaign finance laws and putting those decisions into statute. Now, what's interesting about this is there may be few things in the Capitol more partisan or more sensitive from a partisan nature than campaign finance law. Because if you have one side saying, well, you're doing this all on your own, you're making it fair toward you and unfair toward us. And right now you don't have a bipartisan support for this bill. What Robin Voss and Scott Fitzgerald, the two leaders of both houses, proposed are the big highlights are doubling the campaign contribution limits. Everybody, they haven't changed since the 1970s when they were set. Obviously things have gone up, the cost has gone up since then. They are allowing corporate contributions to political parties in limited amounts. That's something new. They're codifying laws that, you know, there are no more limits on what you take from a PAC, for example, an aggregate limit. Now, you still have a limit of per PAC of X dollars. But before, if you took enough money from various PACs, you were cut off. That was enough. You only so much PAC money. That's gone. The court decision that set that down. So they're codifying these things. But a big change that happened in this amendment that came up yesterday, which was 167 lines of changes that was released about 12:30. They voted on it 4 hours later, include things like, for as long as I've been covering politics in Wisconsin, if you gave at least, I believe, $100 or $200, I can't remember which one it is all of a sudden, you had to list your not only your occupation, but who you worked for. That would pull that requirement away, unless you only have to report your occupation. The idea being that if I work for wispolitics.com and I gave money to Sean Johnson for governor, why does my employer matter? You know, in Republicans' minds, I'm an individual giving money on my own. It's not my employer's money. What's it matter? Well, for Democrats, they're saying, look, we use that to know what industries are trying to influence things or what might be happening that they're trying to put pressure on stuff. So it's a change in approach from what we've been used to in Wisconsin for years.
And also codified in that is that big state Supreme Court decision mm-hmm. that stemmed from John Doe 2, written by Justice Gableman, that really cleared the way for coordination between interest groups and candidates, as long as they don't use some of these magic words of express advocacy. So what is that going to mean tangibly in an election? What can these interest groups do now with campaigns, candidates?
Well, the question is, one, what can they do? And two is, who's going to take advantage of it? I get the impression that for a lot of candidates, they don't want to kind of touch that third rail just yet and see how it goes. I don't expect to be overt, you know, like arm in arm, I'm candidate J.R. Ross, this is interest group A, B, and C, we're going to go together in this campaign and work together, at least overtly. I'm sure there's going to be stuff behind the scenes, but there's still some, I don't know, like hesitancy of, I'm not quite sure how this is going to work or play for me. But that is definitely going to be something to watch going forward is, well, what changes? If you look at John Doe 2, what they were doing was Governor Walker's conservative groups, they had overlaps. They had a guy who's working for Governor Walker's campaign and also who was working for a third party. That apparently is okay now. That third party is directing kind of, you know, here's how I'm going to marshal resources. Well, that's a huge change from before. Go back 17 years, 18 years, 16 years, and then Justice John Wilcox paid a forfeiture to the GAB because his campaign staff had done basically the same thing, had worked with an outside group, Wilcox said, I have no knowledge of this. But it's my campaign. I'm going to take responsibility for it. That then was a no-no. Also now is allowed.
Okay, so if somebody does break the ice someday, you would have potential for this money to go unreported to these groups, and they can work with the campaign.
Candidate Smith can say, look, you know, I'm really pushing my campaign the idea of a tax cut. If you guys would go out and promote the tax cut, that'd be great.
Okay.
And the issue is, he's not talking about, you know, elect me or oppose me, but it's part of my campaign is I want a tax cut. You promote the tax cut. We're all good to go.
Okay. So this wasn't in committee this week, but let's talk real quick about this John Doe bill that's also going to be on the assembly calendar next week, the two-day assembly calendar. What's in this bill? What changes would it make to what we have right now with somewhat obscure John Doe law?
Adds all kinds of new layers of oversight, if you will. You can't have an ongoing investigation. You have to go back to judges and ask them for permission to continue it every so often. You no longer have some sufficient. You no longer have... Now, Democrats have been arguing that this is basically the Corrupt Politician Protection Act, because they say you can no longer go after politicians with this. There'll be something else to watch. But it's just basically a number of checks and balances for Republicans in their minds of, look, we watched John Doe 2 go on forever. We're now going to have some kind of sanity in their minds to what's happening with this process.
Okay, so here's something that we thought might be on the calendar next week, and as of right now, it's not, this online voter registration bill. It started out this big bipartisan bill, sandwiched in the middle of two more partisan GAB and campaign finance bills. All of a sudden, Democrats just start dropping off. What's happening there?
Well, the bill has, so online voter registration is something that Dems like, but it also includes elimination of what are called special registration deputies. So if I'm Group J.R. Ross, and I want to go out to a neighborhood in Madison where I live and register people to vote, I can do that. You can go out and help them get registered and everything else. It would eliminate that position. Republicans have been unhappy with that. If you go back to the Acorn controversies, things like that, they feel like there's some funny business going on, that they're registering people who aren't really eligible to vote or are fake people, just turning in cards, is rife for fraud, you're adding names to the rolls, all these kinds of things. It gets rid of them. Democrats are saying, well, okay, we were working on the bill. We knew this was in there. We're trying to massage it or kind of find some kind of compromise. You guys dropped it Friday afternoon. Here it is with this provision in it. And that blew things up for them. Now, Republicans are kind of going, wait a second. You knew the bill, what was in there. We worked with you on it. We told you about it. Also, now you're, you know, feigning outrage. What's going on? So another example of campaign finance law is difficult to reach compromise on sometimes. And because if you're taking good with bad, sometimes the bad outweighs the good for you.
Okay, so another bill that got kind of hung up in committee this past week, the civil service bill. Thought it was going to get a vote in the Senate committee. Steve Noss's office sends out a notice. Says, in fact, this has been removed from the agenda. Steve Noss doesn't like a provision in there, the ban the box provision. What is that? Why doesn't he like it?
So essentially, on an application for state employment right now, depending on which administration is there, they have the option to ask you up front, do you have a criminal background? Check this box, yes or no. The bill, as currently written, would remove that provision that allows administrations to ask that question. They don't have to, but they can, and so you cannot. Now, if you are, like say, for example, applying for a job as a bank auditor and you've been convicted of bank robbery, that would still be relevant to your job application, right? Because there's a little more of a tie there. But it's a general question up front of have you been convicted of a crime would be pulled off. Steve Noss is saying, look, that's an important question to ask. Your criminal background is part of your personal background. We should be asking that if we want to know up front what's going on. Rep. Steinicke, the assembly co-author, said, look, we want everybody to have a fair shot up front. We don't need that question on there. If they made a mistake 20 years ago, why ask about it? Let's get them in first, go through the process, see who the best person is, and go from there. What's been interesting to watch is I get the sense the assembly's going to pass the bill as is. I don't get the sense that there's a big hang-up. Now, I mean, not to say there aren't members of that caucus who have the same would prefer to see it stay there, but they don't seem to have the same concern that Steve Noss does. So the Assembly might pass its bill, send over and say, okay, Senate, now what are you going to do? That becomes a question. Is this a make-or-break issue for this bill? Governor Walker this week said, look, I can live with or without it. It's up to you guys, whatever you want to do, but let's get the civil service package done.
Okay. The Planned Parenthood's bills took a step in the legislature this week. The fetal tissue bill, Title X funding, let's go with the fetal tissue bill first. There was some question from both legislative leaders, Speaker Voss, Leader Fitzgerald, on whether that had the votes to pass either chamber. Has anything changed?
Last I've heard, almost a month, I think, but Speaker Voss appointed three members of his caucus to try and work out a compromise, if you will, because the question is about the impact on research at UW-Madison, other UW campuses as well, but especially at Madison, of what would this do to the research being done there? Would it undercut the bioscience industry in Wisconsin? So these guys are going to work out a compromise, but you have a dedicated group of people in the Assembly who want the bill as is. So where do they find some kind of deal? I get the sense that they'll let the Assembly go first, try to have them find the compromise, and then send the Senate and try and pass it that way. But right now, it's still kind of on hold.
Okay. And this didn't get a hearing this week or a vote, but there was a bill introduced this week called the Campus Carry Act, which may have gotten more attention than anything we've talked about so far, essentially lift any kind of ban on concealed weapons at college campuses. You could carry them into classrooms. Mm-hmm. Who are the authors, first of all? What are they saying they're pushing this?
Rep. Jesse Kramer and Senator Devin LeMahieu pushed the bill. Basically, it's in the wake of the latest campus shooting in Oregon, saying that these gun-free zones are kind of a magnet for people who can do harm. We need to stop preventing people from expressing their Second Amendment rights and allowing them, if they have a permit, to carry a concealed weapon. Now, it reflects a divide philosophically between the two sides of, is it better to have more guns to protect yourself or to try and keep guns out of the classroom, away from these situations? I get the impression, talking to people this week, that bill is not quite on message for Republicans right now. I mean, yes, I think there are a number of Republicans in the legislature who agree with that philosophically, who do believe that, yes, you should be able to carry a gun into a classroom for your personal safety if you have a concealed carry permit. End of story. But right now, Republicans want to pass the fetal tissue bill, GAB reform, campaign finance reform, John Doe reform, all these things that are their fall agenda, if you will, civil service package. They would knock these things out and then come back next spring, January, February, and knock out kind of like more, if you will, swing voter-friendly bills, and then go home. They really don't want to be taking up controversial stuff in January or February and having the last memory for the voters of this big fight over concealed carry on campuses or things like that. They want to knock this stuff out earlier rather than later. It's a little off message for them right now for what they want to send to voters before they go back to polls next fall.
All right. Jerry, we've got a lot of campaign news to talk about for October of an off year here. Start with the governor. I mean, it's been almost a month now since he got out of the presidential race, and he kind of ripped the Band-Aid off there, right? It wasn't going well. He got out, hasn't really talked about it since. But we have fresh numbers here from his presidential campaign, kind of give an insight to how the money was coming in, but also how it was being spent. He spent a lot on people there.
Yes. We went through his report yesterday quickly, and for what we could gather, at least $1.9 million in this brief window went just toward personnel costs, basically payroll. It was a staggering amount if you think about how brief his campaign was. Now, let's be honest. Governor Walker was running for president the day after he won his re-election as governor last fall. But he launched the Our American Revival 527, which is kind of an issue group early this year. He didn't really transition to being a formal candidate in summer. July 13th, he announced. So he had 71 days as a true candidate. And this report covers that true, like, from exploring announcement to the end. In that window, we spent $6.4 million and raised $7.4 million. Now, that's all we know of. There are other reports out there that he actually has more bills coming in and has debt of maybe $1 million. So, oh, by the way, how do you pay that off when you've already closed down the campaign, aren't running anymore? Where do you raise that money? And, oh, by the way, you're under these contribution limits of $2,700 per donor. How do you pay off $1 million, $2,700 at a time? You're not running for president anymore. It's really a difficult situation for him financially, even though he has been the best fundraiser we've ever seen in Wisconsin. How do you raise money for something like this?
Yeah, right. So we've been hearing this week about how the $10,000 contribution limit to the Wisconsin governor is antiquated. And you have $2,700 a pop. He can't just get a check from a major donor to clear things up at the federal level.
So. Yeah. When the campaign imploded, there are all these kind of postmortems about, like, the question of staffing. Did he need so many people? We went through and counted. I think we had, like, 86 people who were on the payroll that we could count, that were obvious folks with a payroll line and the reason for they were paid. 86 people were on the payroll. That was a story about it was too bloated. Rick Wiley is campaign manager. Kirsten Kukowski is chief spokesperson. They were on pace to make, like, $200,000 each a year. you know, is that maybe excessive? I mean, Colley's questions of why was he spending so much money so quickly. Now, from the other perspective, Scott Walker went from being this unknown to the front runner in the blink of an eye. And so they kind of staffed him up to be the front runner, to project that image, right? Hey, we're the top dog, but it ended up biting him in the end, and now he's got to pay it off somehow.
Kind of puts last Friday's news drop in some new light. The governor released his security costs for the first half of this year, $125,000 through the end of June, about $67,000 of which had not yet been repaid to the state. Now, he does not by law have to repay that to the state. But he said pretty clearly that's going to get repaid. He said it again, it's going to get repaid. If he's facing debts of upwards of $1 million, as has been reported, he has to deal with that. It's not going to be exactly easy to repay that $67,000.
No, and you know, I talked to a couple of lawmakers this week who were like, yeah, people back home know about that. They have asked me in this grocery store, hey, the governor going to pay that money back? Why has he got a tab of $65,000 or whatever it was still left, you know, after from this presidential run? What's going on? So that is definitely an issue for him. Governor Walker he's kind of like in the hangover period, if you will, of his presidential campaign, where he needs this stuff to get behind him so he can move on back to the job of being governor. But these keep popping up and reminding people of the failures of his campaign for the presidency.
Okay, and amidst all that, we did have a hint from the governor this week that, you know, maybe he would want to run for president again, but he wouldn't do it as a sitting governor because he thinks it's too hard to do both at the same time. It sort of contradicts what he was telling us for months there, right? That he's on the phone all the time, he can handle it, in more contact than he's ever been. It's not something he wants to repeat.
It's an acknowledgement to some people that he didn't do it right the first time, that there was something askew about this approach. Now, one thing he said was, you can't run for president while being governor. Well, that promise, he said at one time, remember last fall about running for president, was running for governor? I'm only interested in being governor right now. Go back to his county executive in Milwaukee County. I'm only interested in Milwaukee. I'm not talking about running for governor. Those pledges from Governor Walker may seem kind of hollow, if you will. Some of his critics right now are saying, look, you're saying this, but I don't know what to believe you. And, oh, by the way, he may be talking about running for a third term, but go back to the Marquette poll. Oh, is it like less than 40% of voters want him to run for a third term? I mean, he does have a deficit of goodwill, if you will, right now to try and make up if he wants to be in position to run for a third term in 2018.
Okay, so Governor Walker's out of the race. Other Wisconsin Republicans are moving on. Mm-hmm. Speaker Robin Voss and about a third of his Assembly GOP caucus, just shy, decided they are going to endorse Marco Rubio in the race for governor. You're hearing some chatter around Rubio from some on the right in Wisconsin.
He's coming to do a fundraiser for the Republican Assembly Campaign Committee. He's going to do one for Speaker Voss. He's doing his own fundraiser in Wisconsin. He is making a connection here. Tommy Thompson got on board with Jeb Bush, I think, 2 weeks ago today. I mean, what you're seeing is the vacuum of, okay, Walker's out, now where do we go? Because the hometown guy, you're going to show him deference and wait and see what he does, and you're going to be behind him. But now that he's not, where do we end up? And this is what you're seeing right now, is the divvying up of, okay, I'm going to go this way, I'm going to go this way, and trying to line up support, if you will, because Wisconsin now is right territory for picking people up. And oh, by the way, our April, whatever, 4th or 5th primary that we're going to have seemed kind of like, not that interesting a few months ago because Governor Walker expected to win easily. Now that he's on the ballot, it could be up for grabs. And oh, by the way, the Republican fight for presidency may go to the convention. We don't know yet. I mean, it's a tangled mess right now. So we're also a little bit more important, if you will, to presidential politics than we were a few months ago.
Okay, and we have this U.S. Senate race in Wisconsin that we're looking ahead to. Numbers so far haven't really done much to bolster Ron Johnson's case. I mean, you mentioned that Marquette poll, way behind former Senator Russ Feingold in that poll. Fundraising numbers out this week, not so good for Ron Johnson.
No, he raised about $1 million less, had about the same money cash. Now, we haven't seen final numbers, so I'm saying about
the
cash on hand
said.
Because they say it's 3.5 to 3.4. Wait till the factual numbers come in. But anyway, you know, he's about $1 million behind fundraising-wise. One of the knocks on Feingold in the first report was, okay, this guy's been out of office for a long time. This first run of money is the easy pickings, if you will, the low-hanging fruit. People who've been waiting for Russ Feingold to run again. The fact that he pretty much matched that number from the first 6 weeks again in this quarter, especially over the summer, kind of a sign to his supporters of there is some right picking to do, if you will, for Russ Feingold with these low dollars or small dollar donors. Ron Johnson, you know, look, his number is nothing to laugh at. It's still better than the number of Republicans who are running for Senate right now in re-election, but it's never going to be outraised by your opponent, and there's an issue there. Now, let's be honest as well. The question becomes, how will third parties engage in this campaign starting next year? If third parties come in heavy, they can help out a candidate who's trailing his opponent fundraising-wise. But Ron Johnson has to prove that he is a viable candidate with good resources to make it be a good investment, if you will, his outside groups. If he starts falling more behind Feingold money-wise, it's harder to make that case. That would be more of a warning sign for him. So give him another period to see how he's doing if he picks back up, but this is not the best number, if you will, for Ron Johnson.
Okay, and meanwhile, another Wisconsin Republican could be, the Speaker of the United States House of Representatives. So Paul Ryan has said no in pretty much every way imaginable now. When Boehner dropped out, he said, no way, I'm not going to do it. Boehner's heir apparent drops out of the race, Kevin McCarthy. How many times has Paul Ryan said, no, I'm still not interested? And yet here we are talking about him, and a lot of people think that eventually the party's going to rally around him. Do we know anything more there?
No, I mean, just watch the news out of D.C. It seems like he is taking time to think about it. It's fascinating to watch the establishment talk about Paul Ryan as the only guy who can do the job.
Mm-hmm.
But then you see these outside groups, these conservative groups who are tearing apart Paul Ryan as being not conservative enough. I mean,
he was a hero a few years ago, wasn't he?
Just a few years ago, yes. And what's interesting to watch is, talking to people this week, it's the epitome of dysfunction, if you will, of D.C., that here's a guy who, by one measure I saw this week, would be the most conservative speaker that the country has seen in modern times, is not pure enough. And that's really what's become about in politics, is how pure are you? And for these 40 or so members in the House Freedom Caucus, they want somebody pure. And they have enough people to cause problems that how do you deal with that wing of the party and get things done? I read one report that talked about Ryan would be open to doing it if he can get these guys in this caucus to like be behind him and not cause him problems, if you will. And they're saying, no, we want promise. We want to have a bottom-up approach. We want to have more say what goes to the floor. We want to have our priorities get some preference. And, oh, by the way, now you have people like Steve King in Iowa saying, well, Paul Ryan's pro-amnesty. He's not strong enough on immigration. We can't have that. It's fascinating to watch Paul Ryan having his credentials questioned by people.
And so obvious downsides to Paul Ryan, too, is he gets in. All this goodwill that he has now as Ways and Means chair, prior to that, the budget chair, that's going to go away pretty fast because he's going to start burning some of those bridges just to...
Well, he's got his dream. Talk about this as his dream job, right? To be Ways and Means chair.
And if he wants to be president, Ryan, someday...
That speakership is not the best place to run for presidency. Ooh. I think we've had one be the nominee in, 140 years, 150, something like that. I can't remember the next number is, but it's been a long time since you've had a speaker be the nominee for president. It's not the best place to run from. You have to be on the trail constantly raising money for members. Paul Ryan has a young family. If you look at his calendar, he kind of comes home every weekend to be with his kids, to go to their games, to go hunting with them. He posts pictures on Twitter all the time of him and the kids in a bow, in camouflage. He is not strike the figure of a guy who wants to be part of the D.C. game, constant grind, if you will, which is also why, part reason why he didn't run for president, this year. He didn't want to be in that right now. It's an interesting dynamic of he's the only guy who can do the job, but there's no upside for him either personally or politically right now to do it.
All right. Let's get to your stock report here, Jay. Right. Rising.
The Lake Superior Chippewa. We've been talking about night hunting of deer in Wisconsin for about 25 years. And we finally got a decision from Judge Crabb this week that basically paves the way for the hunt to go forward. Now, this court case has played out off and on for a long time. The Chippewa went back to court in 2012, I think it was, and began this process anew. The Supreme Court this spring refused to hear the appeal of a decision by the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals that basically paved the way again for this to happen. So Crabb's ruling says, okay, here are the rules. You've met these criteria. November 1, you're good to go. Now, that's a win for them, but really this is not about just night hunting deer. It's also about this strained relationship we have in Wisconsin between the state government and the tribes, Native American tribes in the state. You look at the wolf hunt. There are tribes who view the wolf as like a brother, and killing one is like killing a brother. You have the mine in northern Wisconsin that irritated some tribes because they felt like that was a threat to their land, the purity of the land, the resources that they had. You have gaming issues that have been in tension for a while. It's all culminating in things like pushing for night deer hunt, walleye bag limits. Go back this spring, you've had a controversy where the tribes up north and ceded territory, which is basically the northern third of the state, have set their spear fishing limits a little bit high, which leaves fewer fish for other anglers to take. I mean, it's a tension, if you will, of we're not happy with what you're doing, state of Wisconsin, and we're showing you This is a little bit of the undercurrent, if you will, the tension between us going on.
All right. Mixed.
Chris Larson. So, you know, not a lot of tension this week, but he's running for county executive in Milwaukee County. It's interesting. Milwaukee County is obviously a very Democratic county in Wisconsin, right? I mean, this is one of the biggest source of Democratic voters in fall elections. In spring elections, though, it's not quite so deep blue. I mean, Scott Walker won re-election there twice. You know, he won during the controversy over the pension scandal in Milwaukee County, but won re-election twice. Rebecca Bradley, now Supreme Court Justice Rebecca Bradley, very conservative jurist, won retention for her seat. It does have a purple, even maybe a little red hues, if you will, in spring elections. So Chris Abele has not had a lot of fans, if you will, at times, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party in Milwaukee County. But for Larson, you can't just win the Democrats come spring. You have to have like some kind of coalition of a big enough tent to counter the Abele coalition of probably Republicans, probably moderates, and some Democrats. And oh, by the way, Abele has very deep pockets. He can kind of overwhelm Larson, if you will, when it comes to resources. Now, interesting dynamic for Milwaukee County. Next spring, you have a county executive's race, a mayoral race, a Supreme Court race, all the local offices. And oh, by the way, we have presidential primaries coming up in April. Might that change the dynamic in the electorate and help Larson a little bit? I mean, it's a very convoluted path right now for him to beat Abele, and he's definitely the underdog going in.
All right. And falling.
Scott Walker. I mean, the hangover continues his presidential campaign. Walker is doing what he needs to do to get back out there. He's got two stops today. He's touring the state. He's reconnecting, you know, talking about manufacturing. He's got good news. There's a surplus for the budget. Their unemployment is down. But all these things are being upended by the hangover of the campaign where, oh, by the way, Governor, you still owe money for security costs. Oh, by the way, your presidential campaign is maybe $1 million in the hole. Your poll numbers aren't very good. He needs to get out underneath of these bad headlines, if you will, and get back to being governor, get a couple of policy wins under his belt, have an agenda. And here's a big question going forward for Scott Walker. He's talked about running for election in 2018. Does he chart a path where he is trying to win back those moderates who, let's face it, Wisconsin is a blue-leaning state, but not so much in off years, but Governor Walker has done a very good job of connecting with those moderate voters, swing voters, and winning by decent margins. Does he aim to reconnect with them for a 2018 bid, or does he chart a conservative path, keeping in mind a future presidential bid and the primary voters in Iowa and New Hampshire he's trying to connect with the last 8 months? Which path does he take, and how is he doing that, achieving that?
Busy week ahead, busy week behind us. Thanks a lot, JR. This has been Rewind. I'm Sean Johnson.
And I'm JR Ross.